first bill on the agenda is House Bill 122. It's an act relating to the authority to compromise certain misdemeanors. Senator Fisher, do you want to start off with this?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. As you may know, or I'm sure you know, that this was given to me as a subcommittee, and during the interim, I had a chance to talk to people, mainly in the judiciary. And I came away with the conclusion you might as well let the bill go, that the will of the majority should prevail in this particular situation. I'm not sure, personally, that it's the best thing we can do, but the one judge, I think, had a better idea. He said we should just wipe the whole thing off. But I don't propose that, so we'll just leave it go the way it is, and I think there are people here who want to testify. So I would just as soon see the bill move on. There are always two sides of the issue, and I think this is one of those issues that should get to the floor to see where the majority of the people stand.
Thank you, Senator. Barbara Miklos, you wanted to testify on the bill?
My name is Barbara Miklos, and I'm the Executive Director of the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. And this bill was introduced last year at the request of the governor, at the request of the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, and in fact is our top priority for legislation. We feel very strongly that if Alaska is going to have a statute which allows civil compromises in criminal misdemeanors, it's imperative that domestic violence cases are added to the list of exceptions. Most domestic violence assaults are classified as misdemeanors, no matter how serious they may be. Victims are put in increased jeopardy when this can be used as a mechanism for batters to escape retribution. And the way that this works is that when the misdemeanor comes in front of the judge, then if the victim agrees to some sort of recompense, which in a lot of cases is simply a dollar, then the case is totally dismissed. These victims are particularly vulnerable to persuasion by the defendant, be it by promises or threats. If domestic violence victims were not faced with the option, of civil compromise, a means of manipulation by the defendant, his family and friends, or the defense attorney would be abolished. As Governor Cooper stated in his letter accompanying this legislation, the abuse of women and children and the elderly is an offense against every member of civilized society. It is emphatically not a private dispute for which a civil compromise is appropriate. I'd be glad to answer any questions that you have about the legislation. As I said, it's very important legislation to us.
Are there questions by the members of the committee?
Ready for a motion?
No.
More testimony?
Pardon?
More testimony?
Yeah. Okay. I think we have Margo, do you want to say something on this?
Sure.
My name is Margaret Dick, and I'm the coordinator of the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. This bill has been around for about 3 years, and it's been a matter of real concern to the network. Since February of 1986, when the Court of Appeals upheld a case for the use of civil compromise in domestic violence case. And the court in that situation said that the statute in its current form does not exempt domestic disputes. Amendment to create additional exceptions is clearly a matter of legislative rather than judicial concern. Moreover, we note that under the Alaska Civil Compromise Statute, the decision whether to dismiss or prosecute is vested in the sound discretion of the trial court, and no right to dismissal is conferred upon the accused. In cases of domestic violence that appear to involve a continuing danger of injury to the victim, it could well be an abuse of discretion of the trial court to order dismissal. In the present case, however, the state has not suggested any ongoing danger to the victim, and the record contains nothing to indicate that Judge Crutchfield abused his discretion in this regard. In fact, what we know about domestic violence cases is that there is ongoing danger. And ironically, we have a sworn affidavit that the victim in the case that Judge Crutchfield presided over was reassaulted by the defendant after the Court of Appeals case was heard. The key problem is that it's basically impossible for a judge, under the circumstances presented to him or her in an instance of civil compromise, to make an accurate assessment as to the ongoing danger of the victim. information about whether someone has been granted a civil compromise in the past is available only in the judicial district where it was issued. A person can have numerous civil compromises, or as a matter of fact, they can have past or current TROs, arrests, diversions, suspended imposition of sentences or convictions that the judge has no way of, at the time of the civil compromise, of doing the research. Consequently, the judge is forced to rely on his or her questioning of the defendant and the victim, and the questioning of the victim most often takes place with the defendant present in the courtroom. Domestic violence counselors never ask victims questions about what their ongoing danger might be in front of an abuser, because we know that those answers are not reliable. Our position is that we have to build a community response to domestic violence, and that means that the message needs to be very clear and consistent. And that's why we're seeing arrest policies change throughout the country. As a matter of fact, in 1 year, a preferred arrest policy has been adopted it's gone from 10% to 30% of all cities over 100,000. And the same is true of prosecution. And I believe you have in your folder an article from the New York Times talking about judges who speak about the necessity for prosecution in these cases and overcoming the tendency to give the batterer just one more chance before prosecuting these crimes. In addition to clear and consistent message, prosecution does another very important thing. By prosecuting these cases, offenders can be ordered into treatment where it is available. And this is done through a suspended imposition of sentence, which allows for their record to be cleared if they successfully complete the treatment. Do you have any questions?
How does this only apply to physical injury or assault?
Yeah, as I understand it, it's a physical assault. And Gail could probably better answer that question, but as I understand it, it's a physical assault. And all of the cases and affidavits that I've read where civil compromise has been employed, it's all been physical assaults.
So. Thank you. Committee, have questions? Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On 924, when you're talking about a social unit, what's the definition of a social unit?
This is the same definition that's used in the arrest statute, the definition of a social unit is anybody who's living in the household. So, and Gail can give you a specific legal definition, but as I understand it, it's people who are living in the social, it's people who are living in the same dwelling. It might be more expedient to ask the legal questions of Gail or of Stephanie Joannides.
Is somebody else going to testify?
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Department of Law, Gail Horesky, are you going to testify or answer questions?
Mr. Chairman, I'm Gail Horesky from the Department of Public Safety. Stephanie Joannides is here from the Department of Law.
Stephanie's going to answer the questions?
You may not have known that. Yes, I was only going to ask, testify, Mr. Chairman, if there were questions. However, I can address questions previously brought up, if that's your pleasure, sir.
I appreciate it.
To answer, I think it was the Senator Zaroff's question about does this apply only to assaulted crimes. As it's presently drafted, Mr. Chairman, it would apply to any misdemeanor crime committed against a spouse, former spouse, parent, grandparent, etc. So it is broader than assaulted crimes. As I was sitting in the back there, I was trying to think what else would it apply that wouldn't already be covered. For example, if somebody steals from a member of the social unit, that can't be compromised because it's larcenously. The only other thing I could come up with is it might be like a trespass case. If the woman has a TRO and the man violates it, it would apply to that, so that couldn't be civilly compromised. As a practical matter, many cases cannot be compromised now. And so the bulk of cases which would fall under this change would be assault cases. I can't think of anything else that would come under it that's not already prohibited. And there was a question about social unit. Mr. Chairman, I'm not aware of any definition of social unit, but this language is taken verbatim from the language in the domestic violence TRO restraining order statute. And so this is a phrase that the courts have worked with for about 5 years now in terms of defining who gets civil process in these cases. I think that the courts themselves have evolved a working notion of it's not somebody who's temporarily visiting, but if people are living together, then they're seen as members of the same social unit, regardless of whether they are legally married, for example, or regardless of whether they're in-laws versus blood relatives. It focuses on the relationship within the household.
You know, we've hit, you know, some of that consideration in a lot of domestic violence statutes. I'm surprised it isn't somewhere defined.
To my knowledge, it's not, Senator.
Questions by the committee?
Mr. Chairman? Yeah, I guess it's just a little bit unclear to me. As you read down through, you know, maybe compromise there, and then it goes down number 5A, against, okay, a spouse or former spouse. Then you go on, read on down. I think it's not too difficult to understand. But is each one connected? Are each one of those A, B, C, and D, are they connected one way or another, or are they separate entities? I don't see the word or. The only one that has or is number 4. There's a letter C.
Yeah.
So.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, as a matter of drafting interpretation, that or qualifies all those lines.
Okay, so each one is then...
Each one should be read to have an or after it. Because the semicolons mean they're in the same category as the last qualifier there, which is or instead of and. If it were and, you'd have to have all of them. But since it's or, any one, A through D, if they're present, satisfies the condition.
Okay, but then when you read C, against a member of the social unit comprised, then A or B above really doesn't make any difference. So it doesn't make any difference if Senator Binkley and I were living together in a social unit, whatever that might be, and I went over and struck him for no reason at all, then
that would not be a compromisable offense. That's right. And again, this is language taken from the domestic violence TRO.
So it makes it quite broad. Mm-hmm. So when you're looking at a situation then where, I don't even know where I'm going with this. I'm trying to think of what a social unit is. I mean, you know, to me, a small village could be a social unit.
Mr. Chairman, except that it says living together in the same dwelling as the defendant.
Okay, a vessel with a processor with 150 workers on it. All living together as a social unit.
Ultimately, that would be for a court to decide. I suppose that it could be read that broadly. That certainly wasn't the thrust of it. Most crimes are not civilly compromisable. Most crimes are not. And this adds to the list of crimes which are not civilly compromisable. It's a very small change, but its effect on battered women and elders and abused children would be very large.
Yeah, I don't have any problems with what you're trying to do, but I'm looking at, you know, what could be some potential problems in some of the other outlying areas where you have, let's say, as a catcher processor or a processing unit that's operating within state waters, and you do have, you know, disagreements occasionally there, and there. The people that are disagreeing are not related one way or another. And it may be something that could have been worked out. But then under this statute, then, if passed, since there is no clear definition of social unit and they're in the same dwelling, if it's in the confines of the vessel, which they all have to live together, you're not giving any flexibility whatsoever.
Mr. Chairman, the DA brings the charges if they're legally supportable, and in the judgment of the district attorney, it's a case that ought to go forward. If the charges are brought and the person is found guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, then ultimately the sentence is decided upon by the court. So if it's an appropriate case, the defendant could certainly be given a suspended imposition of sentence, could be placed on probation, etc. All those options remain open as they are under current law. The only option that this would foreclose is pressuring the victim into agreeing to drop the charges over the better judgment of the district attorneys and the officers who investigated the case.
Must be why I'm not a lawyer.
What is the reason for civil compromise in the first place, in any case? What's the background of civil compromise?
The background goes back to around the turn of the century when there was a judgment, especially for minor offenses, that if the victim was satisfied, then there was no reason to get the criminal justice system involved. There were numerous states that had civil compromise statutes in some form or another around the turn of the century. Most of those states have since repealed those statutes, and the ones that have not repealed them have very narrowly structured them down and added a lot of conditions and precluded it in second offenses, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I think, as one of the judges evidently told Senator Fisher, that the cleanest thing would just be to repeal the statute outright. It's an anomaly, it's old, it's left over. This was an option that was discussed by the council when they met with the governor to request this bill, because that is a more sensible in the long run and simple way to do it. I think the decision was made, perhaps for political reasons or just, you know, tactical reasons, that because the focus of the council is, in fact, concerned about domestic violence and battered people, that they would concentrate on merely adding domestic violence to the list of things that can't be compromised. I can't speak for the administration. My personal opinion is that the whole statute ought to be repealed. But that's my personal opinion.
Well, we have a title before us that would allow that. It's an act relating to the authority to compromise certain misdemeanors. It appears that the title would allow for the repeal of the civil compromise statute. What argument would we get into from advocates of civil compromise if we were to advocate doing that? I mean, what's the... If you can't compromise a whole bunch of things anyway, it's getting down to where the exceptions are gobbling up the rule. So why not repeal the rule?
I can't give you any reasons why not to repeal it. I suspect that there's a public defender sitting here, and they might come up with some. But the number of crimes that can be simply compromised is very small. For example, DWIs are not compromisable. DWIs aren't even on this list. But the court has determined in other case decisions that where it says here, if the victim has a remedy at civil action, like somebody hits your car and they're drunk, you have a remedy at civil action because you can say, pay me $500 and then I'll fix my car. The court has held that the social interest in preventing drunk driving, leaving the scene of the accident, reckless driving, etc., are greater than the interest of the individual victim. So they've said those aren't compromisable, even though the statute doesn't say it. So, you know, really, if you look at what misdemeanor crimes are compromisable, it's hard even to find any that are. And we always took the position that domestic violence ones were not compromisable because of that same social interest in society at large. It's harmed not just the poor woman that's been battered. And the Nels case caught everybody by surprise. And the Nels case said, well, you know, this is a stupid result, but we can't change what the law says, ask the legislature. I mean, that's what the Nels case said. So that's what we're doing.
What is the feeling of the committee with regard to the whole issue of civil compromise? Senator Bickley?
Well, I was just going to bring out or follow up on Senator Zaroff's point, but, you know, along with that, then you're going to restrict the ability of civil compromise if the instance that he cited, a dispute between a couple of brothers that happen to live in the same household, or two individuals. If Senator Zaroff and I happen to live together and we got in a scuffle and wanted to civilly compromise that outside of the criminal justice system, we wouldn't be able to do that with your current definition.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, in the real world, district attorneys are overworked and desperate to handle the case that they have. If the victim is not interested in proceeding in a case, 99 times out of 100, the district attorney says, hey, fine, get out of my office, I'm too busy. It's only when you're talking about domestic violence cases where the woman has been beaten up 5-6 times and keeps going back to that relationship and keeps being put in the hospital and the children are witnessing this cycle of violence, that the district attorney says, I don't care what you say, you be in court next Wednesday. Because there's a judgment that the social values here transcend whatever impaired judgment for whatever, you know, reasons are going on in that relationship of the victim who's not standing up for her rights. And that's why it's so important to remove this class of cases from the ones that are civilly compromisable. In other situations...
But what you're saying is you can't do that. I mean, you can't make that distinction. I mean, I don't think there's any of us here that disagree with the case that you've just cited or those types of cases, but in the course of doing that, you sweep in the rest of the other examples like Senator Zaroff mentioned.
Well, the language in C, which as I understand, sir, is your focus here, the member of the social unit comprised of those living together in the same dwelling, that is intended to cover people who are living together, like uncles and nephews and, you know, cousins, or I suppose roommates would fit in there, where one person in a power relationship is taking advantage of the other person, and the other person is not feeling safe in his or her own home. And as I say, that's right now in the domestic violence statute. So, for example, using your catcher processor example, if the court were to find that that was a dwelling unit and that was a social unit comprising of 150 unrelated fishermen, which I personally doubt the court would go that far, but if the court did, under your reasoning, fisherman A could get a TRO against fisherman B. And if we're allowing that under present law, I don't see that this is such a different situation. I personally don't think that that's going to come up, because the focus in all these cases is going to be protecting children, protecting women, protecting elders, people who cannot fight back and are in unequal bargaining position in terms of, you know, economic independence. They may depend for their food and shelter on the person who's beating them up.
Maybe the processor is not a good example to use, but how about an apartment complex or a condominium complex where you've got basically the same dwelling?
Mr. Chairman, under the definition of dwelling in Title 11, each apartment is a separate dwelling. So the guy that lives on the second floor is not considered the same social unit as the guy on the first floor. That I can answer as a matter of legal holding, because we've had cases on that.
I'll go back to catch your process.
Senator Ewing?
Thank you. So what you're saying is, in the case of, let's say, a civil compromise where we've got a situation where let's say, two parties work it out, right? Let's say they work it out, they decide not to press criminal charges, then, of course, it would be sort of taken care of. In other words, we'd still have this. In other words, this would be in effect if someone was to press the criminal charges on them, correct?
If something happens and the police aren't called, then nothing ever happens.
Right.
If the police are called and they investigate and they give it to the DA can decline it and nothing ever happens. If the DA decides to file charges, and the victim goes in and says, hey, you know, we worked it out, he gave me the $50 for my car that he hit with a sledgehammer, everything's cool. Unless there is an important public policy reason to proceed with that case, the DA is going to say, hey, fine, I got a rape trial starting tomorrow, I don't want to futz with this nonsense. It's only in the cases where you see this repeat cycle of violence against people that are not on the equal bargaining power that occasionally the district attorney has to say, I know that you love him, you say. I know that he's put you in the hospital 3 times. I am telling you we are going to proceed with this case so we can require that man to get into counseling. And that's what this bill would allow us to do.
So what you're saying through the chair is that you're not taking away their right of civil... What you're saying is you're not really taking your right away from civil compromise, truly. In other words, if they wanted to go ahead and work it out, they could still work it out. Is that correct?
They don't have a statutory right to ask a judge to dismiss the case over the judgment of the prosecutor. What I'm saying, sir, as a practical matter, is unless there is a compelling reason to the contrary, district attorneys are not interested in going forward with cases where the victims aren't complaining.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, then I think I guess maybe the concern that I'm hearing from the committee here or some of the other people is that you're taking some of the rights away from people to be able to work out that civil compromise before having to go to criminal charges.
The civil compromise only occurs after the charges are filed, and then the victim asks the court to dismiss the charges. That's how the civil compromise... So if something is worked out before the charges are filed, that's probably not technically speaking a civil compromise, but it's the way the system works often.
But in your opinion, through the chair, are you taking away any rights for people on A, B, C, or D?
Mr. Chairman, I'm troubled by the word right, because the court has said people don't have a right to civilly compromise. The only, quote, right is the one that's awarded by the passage of this statute. This statute didn't exist. People wouldn't have a right to civilly compromise.
But they have a right under the law.
They have
the
a right
law.
Right now
yeah.
to ask
I would
the judge.
Call that
yes.
A right.
Yes.
Correct.
Okay. Then the answer to your question is yes.
Mr. Chairman, that's the whole reason last time why I wanted to look at it a little bit more is I just feel that I did then, and I guess I still personally feel that you should always have the freedom, if some circumstances come up, to compromise and not continue it through the process. You know, we talk about protecting children, and yet maybe this does, and so the person goes, but the governor can always pardon that person anyhow. Somewhere down the road. But I guess my concern is, I guess I go along with Judge Hanson, that we don't need to build on. And I guess if I could see any support, I'd just as soon as take it off the books and be done with it. Because I respect him as a judge. The other thing I just do want to call your attention to is Judge Crutchfield, and I don't know Judge Crutchfield, but he's saying HB 122 should be defeated, and judges allowed to retain and exercise limited discretion with the circumstances justify such actions on the first page. And yet I do think that, you know, that we need to have this discussion, but personally, I would just as soon as wipe it off the books, period.
Well, what kind of opposition would we get if we drafted a committee substitute that simply repealed the authority for civil compromise?
Mr. Chairman,
let's take a look at it.
I mean, that seems more straightforward.
Yeah, it does. I assume that there would be people in the defense bar in the public defender's office who would oppose that. I assume that. I haven't talked to them to ask.
What do the members of the committee wish to do?
I think we had to take a look at that, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, is this in a subcommittee at all, or did it come out of the subcommittee?
No, Fisher, no. Senator Fisher had it, and we asked if we were ready to bring it forward for discussion, and we're discussing it.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to see it go back into the subcommittee at least, but, you know, I'd like to see it come out and at least do something, at least pursue it a little bit, not just kill it.
Well, we can, we've noticed it, we've had it up, we can sense it, leave it in limbo file available for consideration. If Senator Fisher wants to draft a CS or come back to us with it, it's available to do that.
I guess, Mr. Chairman, what I'd like to, you know, if the committee feels that way, maybe we need to have that before us to look at it and see if we shouldn't just do away with, just repeal it and have some testimony on that angle and just see if, you know, what kind of opposition is there.
Can we get some background from the Department of Law in terms of how many states have repealed the provisions for civil compromise and that kind of stuff? So we've got kind of a background.
Stephanie tells me that she can, yes. This is Stephanie Joyce Medison. Yeah. From the Criminal Division.
Mr. Chairman, can we ask the Judiciary Committee to review this?
Well, the Judiciary Committee passed the bill out with a unanimous due pass.
Right.
This way.
But you were asking there as to our opinion as to what how we would feel about completely repealing the
Well, that's
civil compromise.
That's a good point. Mm-hmm. Why don't we go back at least informally and see what they think about doing that?
Well, possibly we could just draft them a letter or send them a letter and ask them to review it and report back to us.
We don't need to do it by letter. We can just ask.
Okay.
No, I don't object to doing that. I do think, though, that, you know, this being the last part of the session, I do think we need to get some kind of resolution to this, you know, so within the next week or so or 2 weeks.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, unless there's further comment, we'll keep the bill essentially on the calendar for consideration.
This is a House bill, too. This is a House bill. So.
Okay. Yeah.
So it can move pretty fast.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chairman, is that going to be reverted to Senator Fisher's subcommittee? If so, I'd like to be assigned to work with
you
Senator Fisher on that.
Asking about the social
it's a subcommittee of the whole, and anyone that wants to work on it is welcome to do it.
Okay.
Sure, take a motion when you want to make it.
The next item on the agenda is
that's right.
Senate Joint Resolution 11.
Senator
Cogswell has been called. Let's see, do we have anybody else that wants to testify on SJR 11?
What are we doing?
I thought we did this last year.
Is this getting rid of Jones?
Yeah.
Repealing Senator Jones.
For the information of the members, the University of Alaska budget book has been reprinted January 14th because of the changes. It had most of the changes apparently in the budget, and the rest of the changes are in a summary of changes, so you've got those two things to add to your package of books to know where the governor is on his budget. Now you've got governor and governor's amended number one or something.
But these are the only.
And we leave a lot of space in your comparisons for 3, 4, 5, and 6.
Mr. Chairman, I don't see Senator Coghill here, but I've got some some concerns with this, and I'd like to hold it over if you could.
Okay, there is a CS that was drafted because of date changes, if that's what you're concerned
about. No, that's not my concern.
Okay, let's wait till Jack is at least safe.
Okay, okay. That'd be a saving effort.
Mr. Chairman, did you say we do have a committee substitute for this?
Yeah, there is a CS in your file.
Oh, here,
it just
yes,
changes, replaced Elizabeth Dole.
I'm sorry.
Since she's no longer there.
Elizabeth Dole?
Well, she was the Secretary of Transportation when this was drafted last year.
She might
That's
be
the
our
only
first
difference.
Lady.
Well, possible. So, what are we doing here?
I think we're waiting for Senator Coghill to come up.
We're waiting for Senator Coghill.
I thought we did this last year. Oh, that was a resource center.
Let's just taking it easy to turn the thing off. Senator Coghill is with us to address Senate Joint Resolution 11.
Is that right?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Happy to see that you have this resolution up before you, and the hopes that we can get speedy passage through. It's not asking the repeal of the whole Merchant Marine Act of 1920. That goes into an awful lot of other aspects of shipping, but it does ask that we lift that part of the Merchant Marine Act or the Jones Act that adversely affects the coastal trade and prohibits the foreign vessels from competing in our foreign trades. And you have got a CS before you, and the CS, all it does is updates it. Instead of Elizabeth Dole being the Secretary of Transportation, you now have Burn Hayes, the Secretary of Transportation. Mr. Chairman, you know that this is a long, long issue that we've been fighting. We've been fighting this since way back in territorial days when the Jones Act was even more restrictive. I might note that the administration, and I've called their attention to it this morning, hasn't submitted their report to us this year on what the governor is doing as far as his efforts to get the Jones Act repealed. As you know, the initiative 8302, required that the governor of Alaska report to the legislature at the convening of each session as to what action is being taken as far as the repealing of Section 27 really is the section of the Jones Act that we want to repeal. I can go into a lot of detail, Mr. Chairman. I think that every senator around the table has heard a lot of the background as to what the Jones Act is, how it came about, why it came about, what it's doing. If you go back to your Statehood Commission, the Statehood Commission report, which I was the chairman of, we took an awful lot of time on it. We've got a big file on the Jones Act. And actually, if we lifted the Jones Act and we took our royalty oils and we put them into foreign bottom oil at foreign bottom ships, why, it would benefit us between $63 and $176 million more in income per annum. I could go into a lot more detail. I'll answer any questions.
Are there questions from committee members? Senator Ewing.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm very much in favor of the resolution, and I think it's something that we really need. One of the comments that I've heard in the last couple weeks is the fact that in Washington, D.C., I know they're working very hard to do the ANWR project, and from our congressional delegation, I've heard that, let's concentrate on one particular issue, and that might be ANWR. And if we keep pressuring them on the Jones Act and pressuring them on the export of Alaska oil, it's sort of putting fuel on the fire back there. And maybe you could comment on that. Not that I'm not in favor of it, but I just don't want to rub sand into the wound anymore here.
Well, Senator, my reaction to that is that I don't like to be blackmailed any more than anybody else, and I don't think that we have to put those issues together. They're separate issues. The Jones Act is a coastwide trade program, and of course we know where our opposition is. Our opposition is in the maritime. The coastal maritime companies of the West Coast and the East Coast, and it's a protective system, and Hawaii is doing the same thing. They're trying to also get unleashed from the restrictions of this. And we're not asking them to repeal the whole act. We're just asking them to modify Section 27 of the act. So I don't think that it would get into the ANWR issue. Maybe export of oil would.
Mr. Chairman, maybe the joint resolution wouldn't have any effect, but I know that that's a comment that I'm getting from other people who are going to Washington, D.C. They're trying to advocate for this when we've got Anwar going on at the same time. Just a comment so that you're aware of that.
Well, I think that Senator or Mr. Chairman, I think that your concerns are well founded, except we're right in the middle of some fish treaty negotiations with Canada too, and the free trade of Canada, and I think that because the federal government has gotten you might say too many spoons in our pudding, that we have to go to them and to try and rectify some of these things.
Senator Binkley, you had some questions or wanted to hold the resolution?
I would like to, Mr. Chairman, hold this over for a day or until the next meeting. I've got some concerns and I wanted to go back and take a look at it. I know we've had this bill in committee since last March.
Chairman, it does not take the exemption off of the Yukon River.
Well, that was one of my concerns.
No, it does not. That's in a different section. That's in section four. I would make sure that that's because we have three barges that were built in Dawson too, in the Nenana port.
I didn't hear that question.
I don't know that I actually stated the question.
But if the senator, Mr. Chairman, has any specific questions, I'd be more than happy. I've lived with this thing for about 20 years.
If we could, Mr. Chairman, just hold it over. Would you have any objection to that, Senator Coghill? I know it's been in the committee since last March.
Yeah, I thought you'd had plenty of time.
let's hold the resolution until Friday, and we'll take it up then.
Great.
Okay.
Did we ever adopt a committee substitute?
No, we didn't. Do you want to go ahead and adopt a committee substitute and hold it to CS?
Yeah, I'd be glad to do that. I would move and ask unanimous consent that we would go ahead and adopt the committee substitute for Senate Joint Resolution Number 11 as a working draft.
Are there any objections? Committee substitute for Senate Joint Resolution Number 11 is adopted as a working draft. Unless there is any further business to come before the Finance Committee, we're adjourned until Friday.